Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today our travels on Route 51 take us to two different worlds, deep into the Amazon rainforest of Guyana, 200 miles from the nearest road, into the small village of an indigenous tribe of Amer Indians. And then we go back to so-called civilization, to the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point, where an amazing one-of-a-kind cultural exchange program has unfolded over the past few months. Our guest is UW-Stevens Point Professor of Anthropology Stephanie Alamon, who has spent many months over the past 12 years living with the tribe known as the Waiwai, learning how to speak their language, prepare their food, share their joys and sorrows, and working to help them preserve their heritage. This fall, Dr. Alamon brought two of the Waiwai tribesmen back with her to Stevens Point, Wachana Yaimochi and his son Ruben. We'll hear how the two tribesmen reacted to America's consumer-based way of life, and we'll hear how Ruben plans to come back to Stevens Point and get a college degree, not to integrate with our world, but to help him preserve the culture of his people and the world they live in. This is a fascinating story. Stephanie Alamon is with us for the next hour, and we would like you to be with us, too. If you have any questions of her and the way of life that she has lived at least part-time for the last 12 years, give us a phone call. Our lines are open at 261-6371. That's 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. Stephanie, welcome to Route 51.
Hi, Glenn. Thanks.
And I want to tell you how much I enjoyed spending some time with you and Wachana and Ruben. And I think before we go forward with the conversation, I'm going to play the piece that we put together, which gives you an idea of what these two gentlemen from the Waiwai tribe are like and how they were trying to adapt to our society, much as you tried to adapt to theirs. Wachana Yaimochi takes a small machete blade to a white pine branch, shaving it to the right shape and size for the thatched roof he's putting on a traditional Amazonian round hut, looking very out of place in Stevens Point on a frosty November day. He turns to his son, Ruben, and the two converse in a language known by only 1,500 people in the world. Wachana and Ruben are speaking in Waiwai, the language named for their tribe, an indigenous Amerindian people who live in Guyana, deep in the Amazon jungle.
Weather is different from our place. This place is very cool.
Wachana's small village of 300 people used to be bigger before many of them moved even farther into the jungle to Brazil.
We had a big village, but all the Waiwai them gone away to Brazil.
Are you worried that your people are going to disappear, that there won't be any more Waiwai?
I don't think so.
The woman who brought Wachana and Ruben to Stevens Point, anthropologist Stephanie Alamon, doesn't think the Waiwais will vanish either.
The Waiwai have a strong sense of themselves and what they want to be. They know they're Waiwais. They're not trying to not be Waiwais.
Stephanie's relationship with the tribe goes back to 1997, when she first tried and failed to penetrate the dense jungle.
When I finally reached the farthest place I could go, the next day I came down with a high fever and was diagnosed with malaria.
But Stephanie returned later and spent 8 months with the Waiwai, learning how to grind the poisonous manioc root into tapioca and eating wild pigs, capybaras, and tapirs shot with bows and arrows handcrafted by young tribesmen like Ruben.
When you get a tapir, well, you have to shear.
They'll divide it among families.
Yes.
Let's say Ruben killed the tapir. He would want to give some meat to his father-in-law, to his own family, his mother, maybe somebody who hunted with him.
Ruben Yaimochi is 20 years old and straddling two worlds. His English is good because he attended high school. And while he and his wife and daughter still live with their tribe, he also now has a laptop computer.
Young men his age want a computer, and he knew how to use it. And they have an internet connection in the village now, which is kind of an amazing thing. And he just talked to his wife earlier today and saw their baby.
Change is coming to the Waiwai, who are struggling to adapt to the future without losing their way of life. Ruben thinks he can help by getting a degree in biology, perhaps at UW Stevens Point.
So I want to be a biologist in the future, maybe if I get the degree.
Does that mean you'll move out of the village at some time?
No, but I will be helping the village because our village now is a protected area, and one of the things that we want to preserve is the biodiversity.
Stephanie Alleman thinks that while the YY can learn from us, we can also learn from them.
People long for a deeper relationship with their environment, a closer connection through kinship rather than just a series of random stranger-type relationships. And these are the foundations of all Amerindian cultures.
On Saturday, Ruben and Wachana flew back to the YY village deep in the jungle. But Ruben plans to come back next year to get that biology degree. In Stevens Point, I'm Glenn Moberg for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Stephanie Alleman is with us for the next hour, and we are welcoming your calls, your questions, and your comments, 2616371, 2616371, or 1-800-780-9742. Stephanie, you took Ruben and Wachana back to Miami this past week, and then they flew on to Guyana. How did they feel about their visit to Stevens Point?
I think that by the time they were leaving, they had a feeling that it might be time to go back because they were heavily laden with things they wanted to give to their families, and also, I think, mentally laden with so many things they had seen and done. And even though I tried to give them a number of days, you know, where we just really didn't do anything, I think even myself, once they had left, I started thinking back on all the things we had done and realized how long it was going to take to unpack all that. And I'm sure they were doing the same thing.
How difficult do you think it'll be for them to adjust back to their world?
I actually think they already have. I spoke to them several times since they've been back. And one of the quickest ways that I could tell Wachana has reimmersed himself is that he doesn't talk to me via the computer or anything anymore. And he'll wait until he gets back to the village and then maybe he'll talk to me again. But, he's not used to talking while he's traveling. So he just doesn't. It's like he's not really there.
Did you play that piece for them that we produced for Wisconsin Public Radio?
I did. I was able to send it as an email attachment to Ruben.
Unbelievable.
And he listened to it and he wrote back and he said, "Wow, we sound really good, Stephanie." And and I know he played it for his father, and I think he even sent it on ahead of them to the village where they also have an internet connection for the village to hear.
And that's amazing in itself. We'll be exploring that in a few minutes. 2616371 or 1-800-780-9742. Let's go to the phones. Ned in Wausau, you're on Route 51. Hello, Ned.
Hi, I just wanted to say that this is such an interesting story, and the interest in teaching biology hits home, close to home for me because that's what I teach here at UWMC.
Ned Grossnickel, biology professor at UWMC. Go on, Ned.
Yeah, and I just was interested in the interest in biology and how they're going to, assuming this is successful and the student is able to come next year, what is the goal exactly that they want to use the biology in exactly when they return back to their country?
Sure. Hi, Ned. Well, Conservation International has had some interaction with the YY. They actually helped them establish the territory they live in as a protected area. And one of their initial programs was to train young men to be both forest rangers and, as they call them, parabiologists, so that they can do a number of diagnostic sort of readings of water and climate change and biodiversity and the other things that Conservation International is interested in. And my thought was that I've known Ruben a long time, and I asked him, you know, what would you like to do? And he's trying to think of something that would offer him a chance to work in the village, but actually be of help to the village, but would actually give him an income. And this is something that he can pursue, sort of getting a professional degree, I guess, as a forest ranger.
Well, I just think that's wonderful. I just think we need more, though, of that type of learning and returning back to your home country and being able to use it for such good causes is just an outstanding story to tell.
And, Ned, while you're on the line, Stephanie, this area that they live in is protected by Guyana, is it not?
That's right. They just recently signed the agreement to make their territory into what's called a protected area, and it's an agreement between the government of Guyana, the YY themselves, and Conservation International that they won't use the area for illegal mining, timber extraction, and or any other purpose that would deplete or threaten the biodiversity of the area.
It sounds like one of the biodiversity hotspots around the world, which is the exact areas that we need to give the highest priority in terms of saving whatever natural systems are still left from all sorts of deforestation, mining, et cetera. So I think this is just a great program.
Ned, thanks so much for the phone call.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. You know, they're 200 miles from the nearest road. They're in an isolated stretch of the Amazon rainforest. Sure, they're protected, but who's going to police it? Who's going to make sure that these timber interests don't come in there, that local farmers, local people trying to make a living, that they don't slash and burn the rainforest and defeat what you're trying to do to protect the place?
Right. I think, you know, that's probably the thinking behind some of the training for people to actually allow them to police their own area and give them the support, the training and the sort of means to be able to do that. And then that support extends to this larger entity, you know, like the NGO, Conservation International, the government, so that people understand there's consequences, even though there might not be a local presence to deter them, like a fence or, you know, or a lot of police in the area, that the people know what's going on there and are aware of what's going on there. And that's certainly the case.
So the YY, the indigenous people, they're the ones on the forefront of trying to protect the rainforest instead of, as we hear so often, indigenous people being the problem instead of the solution.
That's right. And the other part of that is that they have long been actually patrolling that area because they're on the border with Brazil. So the northern border of Brazil and the southern border of Guyana are very close, and there are no other human presence in the area. And so the Guyanese army and the nation has really always relied on them to sort of monitor what's going on there and to let people know.
Stephanie Alleman, we're talking about her life with the YY deep in the Amazon rainforest and their life with us. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. If you'd like to join the conversation, 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. There's a line available for you right now. We'll be back after these short messages.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, providing Employee Benefits Administration, Integrated Health Management, and Pharmacy Benefits Administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
If you just joined us, we're talking to anthropology professor Stephanie Alleman of UW-Stevens Point. The months she spent with an indigenous Amerindian tribe in the Amazon rainforest and then bringing two of the tribesmen back with her to Stevens Point, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742 if you would like to join the conversation. Stephanie, why the YY? What got you interested in this particular tribe?
I was wondering when you get to that, Glenn. Everyone gets there at some point. I usually say because when they ask me that. I think what started it for me was I started out as a botany student. I wanted to study plants. I loved plant anatomy and everything about plants that I could learn. And in my senior year of college at Madison, I got to go to Venezuela on a sort of a capstone field course. And I realized that something was missing. And what was missing is that I didn't understand how the people who lived with all the plants we were working with felt about them. And that I only understood sort of how these northern people felt about tropical plants. And that seemed like something was missing there. And I shifted my attention to the people pretty quickly. And from there, going into anthropology, having to do a field research component for your PhD, I didn't just throw a dart on a map of the Amazon, but something sort of close to that. I did look to see, you know, what groups were available in different areas that hadn't been visited by 100 other anthropologists that were in an area that would be interesting for its plants as well as for its cultures, and Southern Guyana, English speaking. The YY were there in the corner of the map, and it just seemed like the perfect fit. And so from there, I pursued that as a possibility, and it turned out pretty well.
What knowledge of their indigenous plants do these people have that we haven't discovered yet as scientists in America?
I think that what I work on as an ethnobotanist is not simply maybe the chemical properties of plants or the useful practical products that you can make from plants, but the symbolic usages. And I think if there's one thing we haven't understood about the relationship that people have with their environments, who actually use the environment extensively for their subsistence and their livelihood, is the extent to which they embed those symbolic systems in the way they think about the world and actually the way they think about other people.
But still, you hear that there are plants that haven't been discovered yet that could have properties. They might cure cancer. There might be things like quinine, which we found in the bark of a tree that helped protect sailors many hundreds of years ago. That might be out there. Is there any effort right now to use tribespeople like the YY to maybe advance medical research?
Right. Well, I think the impetus of ethnobotany as a discipline, where it's the relationship between people and plants, really had a big push in that direction. The work of Mark Plotkin, who some people might know, The Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice, and his work in the Amazon, and other researchers, Wade Davis, and even some of our more mainstream sort of new age ethnobotanists like Andrew Weil and people who've worked with plant medicines before, have given us this idea of the sort of medicine chest of the planet for the Amazon. And certainly that's an important thing. Anthropologically, what happened there, or I guess the human factor that sort of entered in, was that it's hard to understand the value you could place on knowledge, how you would compensate people for that knowledge, and then how the legal issues would enact about how you would make revenue from that knowledge. And so rather than having just a full-out pursuit of those kinds of knowledges, things become trapped in arguments about intellectual property rights and who owns the knowledge and what's going to happen to the profits that such knowledge might actually generate.
You know, people who are listening to this conversation right now and listening to you talk about ethnobiology and intellectual property rights probably have a hard time picturing you living in the middle of the Amazon rainforest for 8 months straight with these people, eating tapirs and wild pigs and capybaras and learning how to pound the root of the manioc plant in order to make tapioca. Do you feel a little bit schizophrenic sometimes?
I actually do, and I feel more that way when I'm thinking about it, even in the classroom when I insert sort of stories of my fieldwork in. I realize that I have this ability almost not just to speak multiple languages, but to speak in different ways about different things. And I noticed that the most when the YY were actually here with me, and I would try to explain things about our culture to them rather than the other way. I'm actually much better at explaining YY culture in a way that we would understand than I am in trying to explain to them in their sort of cultural frame what it is we're doing.
Maybe their culture makes more sense in some ways.
Right.
Tell us about that first trip back in 1997. Here you were, a young lady trying to penetrate the deep Amazonian rainforest, and you didn't get very far.
No, I didn't. There's two main factors that impeded me then, and the first was a sort of political. In spite of our ability to travel all around the world, we're still impeded quite a bit by just the old-fashioned boundaries that exist between our nations, and the permissions and the logistics of actually traveling sometimes are the most difficult. And I was in the capital city of Guyana for 7 weeks before I was given permission to actually leave for the interior, and there's a lot of gatekeeping activities surrounding the interior of Guyana. Most people don't live there. They live on the coast.
But then you went in and you could never, you never even made it to the village.
No, I didn't. After this long wait of getting in, I got in as far as a sort of northern savanna town. And then from there, you either have to go in walking, if you're lucky enough that somebody's gotten a charter plane, which probably isn't going to happen, or a tractor that will pull, you know, a cart behind it. And I met YYs there at this village on the savannah, and I talked to them about coming to the village, and we made a plan. And that evening I got a really high fever, and I was hallucinating, seeing giant lizards and all kinds of interesting things I'd never seen before. And the next day they came and took a blood smear and told me I was positive for malaria, so I actually had to come back to America right then.
This is a dangerous spot of the world, isn't it? Malaria, panthers, anacondas.
Well, that's another interesting thing, because I actually think I got the malaria in Georgetown, in the coastal city. And by the time I'd gotten to the savannah, there's all kinds of interesting environmental dangers, but I always felt safer the further into the jungle I went, especially with the Waiwai, who know what they're doing and know the environment, and it's none of the natural threats. It's usually other people that you end up being more concerned about.
Many of the people who are listening right now, if you were to suddenly put them in the middle of the Amazon rainforest in the Waiwai village, listening to the sounds of the jungle at night with no lights, in the pitch darkness, listening to the panthers and the creatures, they'd be scared to death, and for good reason. Weren't you ever frightened when you were in that environment?
I think the thing that might come across is that you might get this image that you're sort of camping out, you know, it's just, there's nothing but a mosquito net between you and the rest of the jungle. But, you know, Amerindians create a very, I don't know, womb-like social atmosphere. I mean, you're not sleeping in the jungle, you're sleeping in the village, and you're sleeping inside with families, and the hammock itself is kind of protective. And even though there's not really anything between you and the outside, there are no locks, there's no need for anything like that, there's no fences. And so you actually end up feeling more protected in the village than you would think.
How long did it take for the Waiwai to accept you?
I think they accepted me pretty much right away, although if you broke that down by gender, I could say, or even age, the old people really liked me, the young people really liked me, the middle-aged people weren't too sure, and especially the women weren't too sure, because they didn't know what I was going to do. And I think the main thing was to participate in life in such a way that would show them that I actually cared about what they were doing and not mark myself as different. So eating what they were eating, doing what people are doing, asking if I can work to help people.
Participating in life in the Amazon rainforest, a world away. Stephanie Alleman, professor of anthropology at UW Stevens Point, 261-6371, 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51. We'll be back after this news. We're back on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio with anthropologist Stephanie Alleman, a lady who traveled from Stevens Point down to the rainforest in Guyana, lived with an indigenous Amerindian tribe for months, has done it numerous times during the past 12 years, then brought two of the tribe's people back with her to Stevens Point. We're talking about the clash between these two cultures, their values, our values, what they can learn from us, what we can learn from them, and whether there's really any hope of preserving their culture and their lifestyle and their language in this increasingly crowded and technically sophisticated world. We want to hear from you, 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. How did the Waiwai, how do the Waiwai preserve their food? It's very hot in the Amazon rainforest, and they're killing big animals, wild pigs, tapirs, capybaras. How do they preserve that?
Well, they don't preserve a lot. Basically, if you kill something big, everybody eats it. You don't preserve it and share it out over a number of weeks. But if you were hunting and you wanted to preserve things because you were out for a few days, They're the ones who invented the barbecue, the smoking, not the Waiwai, but I mean Amerindian peoples, the smoking of meats and the preserving. And they also use salt, especially for fish. So they'll get large quantities of salt and then preserve things with salt and smoking.
If they kill a tapir, it's a big deal.
That's right. That's the largest animal I guess you could get. And except if you got a whole bunch of bush hogs, you could also get five or six bush hogs. That would be a big meat catch as well.
Big party for the village when that happens?
The equivalent of a big party is in Waiwai called Onahari, and it basically means almost come and get it, or here it is. And it's a communal meal in which the meat is shared out amongst households who cook it and then bring it back to the communal house, and everyone eats together.
Do they use guns when they're hunting?
They do. They have 20-gauge and 12-gauge shotguns. Most of the time, they rebuild those at least once or twice a year. They're not sophisticated. But most of them are still hunting either with a gun if they can get it, but there aren't enough for everyone, right? And then they need shells, but with traditional bow and arrows.
And Ruben, the young gentleman that you brought back with you, he made his own bows and arrows.
He did. Ruben is 20 years old now, and actually going to be 20 on the 20th of this month. And he's in the age category they call Kari Famsham, which means he's expected to, number one, take a wife, which he did, and number two, represent his family through being able to hunt and not just fish. And so he's actually able to make his own hunting implements as well as use them.
And they fish.
That's right. They live in a riverine area and are very dependent on the river. A lot of their lives are lived not just near the river, but actually on it.
Is this the Amazon River?
No, it's not. It's the Essequibo River, which is the main river running through the country of Guyana. It runs north out to the coast and drains into the ocean at the coast.
So how do they fish? Do they use rods and reels? They're using shotguns when they can get them. Do they have fishing equipment like we have?
The fishing equipment they have that's like ours is there because we gave it to them. They one of their main things they like for trade items is fish hooks and line, the lead to sink fish hooks. But they also hunt a lot of fruit-eating species in which they would just tie a fruit to a piece of line, and then they make a rod but not a reel. And it's almost a kind of a fly fishing sort of action that knocks the fruit against the surface of the water, and they catch fish that way as well.
And they do some agriculture as well.
Yes, they do. They also have at least three farms per family. There's an active farm, one that's sort of falling off, and one that they've recently planted. So their main staple is cassava, which is also known as manioc. It's a bitter root that you have to prepare in order to make it into bread.
And is that also the source of tapioca?
It is. That's a sweet variety of cassava. So the difference is this amount of this poisonous acid that has to be extracted before you can eat it.
Did you learn how to prepare it?
I did. The YY have kind of a gendered division of labor in which both males and females have to do jobs. If they didn't do, society wouldn't continue. And one of those jobs for women is to process cassava. And so that's what women are doing. That's what I was going to do too. And it's a chance for them to actually, they don't just work in those situations. It's a chance for them to discuss sort of village things, to learn things that women are supposed to know. And so those communal working groups are very important to the transmission of their cultural knowledge to each other.
The manioc root is very poisonous. How in the world did this tribe, or any of the tribes in the Amazon, learn how to prepare this without it killing them first?
Yeah, I think that was probably the subject of a lot of anthropological research over many years to try and determine this kind of trial and error situation. And I guess it's kind of the same with any complex culinary process, is how in the world did people ever arrive at this preparation level in order to eat this? And I think part of it is a sort of a cultural thing, that there is the attention being paid to the need to actually work on this product, but it holds with a lot of Amerindian principles about transforming wild things into cultural things so that they're appropriate for use. And this is a really good example of that the harder it is to make it edible, the more culture goes to work on it, and that's significant for them.
And once again, I guess the question is, you know, after the 10th time that it's killed somebody, you'd think they'd give up on it before, before working even harder on it. You mentioned that Ruben was expected to take a wife at the age of 20. They're monogamous, correct? A monogamous tribe?
Yes, and that's partly because they've had missionaries in the village, not now, but had missionary visitations in the 1950s. And
what were they like before that?
It's not as if they're sort of, you know, gregariously polygamous, but they did have some incidences of sort of women with multiple husbands, mainly so that there would be husband-wife relationships for the doing of tasks and chores. And so it doesn't necessarily mean that you're married to more than one person, but they would incorporate multiple people into their households previous to that. But missionary presence suggested to them that there should be one couple per family, and that was the way to live.
And do couples stay married for their entire lives?
They do, and that's actually one of the nice things to see in the village is especially young couples who've known each other all their life anyway before they got married, be able to talk about the same things that have happened to them all their lives and the same people that they've known, and then as old people still be able to talk about those things. And it's just long-term intimate relationships that result from those kinds of relationships.
And as you said, everybody knows everybody. There are only less than 300 people in the village, and then what, another 1,200, 1,500 in Brazil?
That's right. So everyone's pretty much related to somebody else, yeah.
How can you be so confident that they'll keep their language and keep their culture when there are so few of them?
I think that for the YY, one of the easiest ways to tell this is the fact that in the village, language is the primary feature that recognizes that they're YY. They speak YY in the village. They speak YY to each other. They don't, they haven't lost their language, and they haven't had anyone trying to take it from them so that they weren't forced to learn English and have a lot of the other assimilation practices sort of enacted upon them. And because of where they live, they've been isolated enough from other large populations that they haven't had the pressure to sort of acculturate either.
Do you have any record of what their religion was like before the missionaries came? It's not that long ago, back in the 50s. Did they have their own gods?
Yes, I think there's really good documentation of what YY belief systems were like. And actually now it's a blend of those traditional belief systems with Christianity. So they haven't replaced one with the other. So it's still possible to talk to people about their spirituality and what they believe and not just get a sort of Christian answer. They did have a primary sort of God figure and then a lot of lesser spirits and spirits that inhabit the forest, and they're animistic, meaning that they believe that everything has a soul.
Well,
and
it sounds like Hinduism in that respect, in some
right.
ways.
Right, in some ways, yeah, and so that they would be believing in the animate ability of almost all objects and things.
What of the old religion's features have they retained?
I think one of the key features is their belief in the spirit essence or the living spirit essence of beings of the forest. And this is mainly because they still have to live in the forest, use the forest, and interact with those powers and presences on a daily basis. And so those kinds of templates for understanding their environment are still really important to them.
Do they have any myths, legends, or stories about the past or any revelation-like stories about the future?
A lot of the interesting things that I started to learn about the way that they describe the universe have to do with ideas of cyclical time, that something has happened and it'll probably happen like that again. And one of the best examples I have of that is actually in the year 2000, they experienced a flood which covered almost the whole village, and they moved to a new village site. And so they were spending a lot of time talking about floods. You know, it was during the millennium, right? So there was a lot
right.
of end of the world kind of like ideologies that they knew about. They sort of looked at the Bible, you know, this is an inundation and everything. And they searched a lot of different answers for why those things were happening. And you could see that the answers they came up with were blending of all these different ideas that they could put together.
You know, here in America, we look back on our heroes, the founding fathers and the pioneers. Do they have any legendary figures like that they still talk about deep back in their history?
Mm-hmm. I think the people who are legend are not people who are mythic characters, you know, who they're not sure existed or not, but they're really past village leaders who did something significant for the people. And there's not a long line of those people stretching back, you know, many generations. It's usually the people within living memory, like the last 20, 30 years. They're talked about quite a bit.
Now, one of the things that you did is you brought laptop computers to them, and as you mentioned, when Ruben was here in Stevens Point, he could look at his wife and his child in this village way out in the rainforest. Did you worry as an anthropologist that you weren't just observing these people, you were changing them?
Yeah, I, th- I think the main thing about the anthropological fieldwork, especially in this kind of situation where you know that the place that you're coming from is radically different from the place that you're going to, I think if they hadn't have asked me for those things, I don't think the border between my world and their world is as solid as either one of us probably thought, and or any of us maybe think, that there's really not that much difference between them and us other than the history of what we've experienced. But our desires are very much the same. They use the computer for communication. I mean, that's what they've really come down to. They're not sort of knowledge hungry in the same way that they're interested in being able to use it to talk to themselves.
And Ruben, when I talked to him when he was here this past week, said that the village elders are keeping tabs on how much time people are spending on the internet. It sounds like what parents have to do with kids in order to maintain the purity of the culture.
I think what it is more they're trying to see what it is they're looking at, and it exactly like parental control, because I think what's really on the minds of the village leadership is the sort of ability to access bad things. They don't want, you know, sort of pornographic videos in the village, and it's okay to watch soccer, but maybe not, you know, these adult things. And they screen music the same way. They want to know if the lyrics are bad or if they're good lyrics. And you know, in that sense, they're just talking about the public. They don't really tell people they can't do that in the privacy of their own home, as it were. But for the village, they want to make sure that the children especially aren't being exposed to things that they couldn't handle.
How many hours do they work during a day, and how many hours do they play? And can you even tell the difference between the two?
Right. I would say it's not even on a daily basis that you know, I mean, there's certain things you have to do when you get up in the morning, like catch fire and make yourself something to eat. But then the day's activities can stretch out in a number of ways. You need to weed the farm, maybe. You might have to go fishing. You might go hunting, but you do that at night, so that wouldn't be during the day. You might want to make, you know, some implements or crafts. There's certainly time for pretty much all those things. And people don't feel pressured into schedules of short time frames. And so if it takes a week to do something, that's okay. If it takes a month to do something, that's okay too.
Do they drink alcohol, or do they use other psychoactive substances like marijuana?
The YY actually live in the central, sort of north central Amazon. The northwest Amazon is known for its tribes that use most of the hallucinogenic plants and use them for religious purposes, and they don't. Previously they used tobacco. They were tobacco shamans. They used the smoke. There's, you know, as some of you may know, if you drink enough tobacco juice, you can start seeing things, and that was their sort of hallucinogenic drug of choice. Alcohol was discouraged by the missionaries. Their form of alcohol is fermented palm fruit drink that you drink. You know, you'd probably get sick before you got really drunk, and that's kind of the point. And then you go back and you drink some the next day. So right now, there's no drinking, no smoking, nothing like that in the YY village, and that's kind of a tacit agreement amongst the people that live there that they won't smoke cigarettes, they won't drink, and they won't bring drugs into the village.
Stephanie Alleman, Life with the YY, an indigenous Amerindian tribe deep in the Amazon rainforest. She lived with them for many months, brought two of the YY tribesmen, Wachana and Ruben, back with her for the past few months. At UW-Stevens Point, they've just flown back to their village. Ruben wants to come back and get a biology degree so he can help his village maintain the biodiversity of the Amazon rainforest. It's a fascinating story. We've got about another 8 minutes or so of the show. If you'd like to join us, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We will be back after this.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, providing Employee Benefits Administration, Integrated Health Management, and Pharmacy Benefits Administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
Ruben and Wachana got to go hunting, not just there, but up here.
They did, and at the risk of sort of sounding like I orchestrated a number of interesting activities for them, my advisor at Madison, my old advisor, Neil Whitehead, is also an Amazonianist, and he's also an avid hunter. And we've been talking for a long time about, we should just let these guys hunt. I mean, they should be able to see what it's like, and this would be something that they would enjoy, and I can't actually take him hunting. So he arranged for them to go, and they went to hunt pheasant, and they were successful in that. And ate the bird and then collected the feathers and started using the feathers in some of their craft work.
When I was in your living room, we saw it looked like a stiff headband called an arroco. And they were putting the pheasant feathers into that, which, if they were back in the rainforest, they'd be using macaw feathers. What's the significance of that?
The arroco is a really brilliant, because of the macaw feathers, what we call feather diadem, or just encircles the head. And the YY traditionally wear it to call the sun when it's been raining for too long, sort of the opposite of the rain dance. And it's supposed to appeal to the sun that he would want to come out and see these brilliant feathers, which are also like his own. And the other main purpose is to make people look Chen Forem, which is the word for beautiful, and really knock people down with how beautiful they are. It's like a competition.
We also had an exercise in what you call ethno-astronomy at the Blocker Planetarium on campus.
That's right. Randy Olson, the director, was really kind enough to allow us a private session in the planetarium, where we asked if he would bring up the night sky in southern Guyana over the YY's village and allow us to start naming some of the constellations. And this is something I've done with the YY in the village dozens of times. But I wanted to initiate a project in which they would be able to not only recognize those same things in the sort of planetarium sky, but that we might be able to develop a program which actually showed what those constellations were, that they're all named, and what their significance was.
How did the other students react to Ruben while he was here? I venture to say he was the first and only YY that's ever attended UW-Stevens Point.
Probably, yeah. I have to say, all of the students that interacted with Ruben were wonderful to him, genuinely interested in what he, had to say and who he was and where he was. I think one of his favorite things to do outside of the university was he took Taekwondo, and he was really embraced by the students in that class and was able to advance. He got, he went through two belt tests and was, on his way to his third before he had to go home, and they told him how much they were going to miss him. So, I don't think he was surprised, but I think he was really appreciative of the fact that people were so kind. I can't recall one negative experience he must have had with somebody the whole time he was here.
Well, change is coming to their world. They've got laptop computers. They're not living totally isolated lives. What parts of their world and their culture do you think the YY would like to keep, and what parts would they like to change?
I think they'd like to change what they perceive as their low economic status. They don't have a lot of buying power. They don't have an economy that's money-based. And so when they say something like, I'm not working, I don't have money, I mean, that really means something to them. I think they'd like to have access to money. I don't think they want to become millionaires, but they understand that that's the way to trade certain products, and they don't have what people want to trade with. And so they're interested in that. As far as keeping things the same, I think they want to be able to live where they're living, to eat the foods that they can, that they've always hunted and prepared. And kinship-wise, they want to keep their lifestyle and the people that they're with going strong, and just recreate YY-ness rather than translate that into some other kind of world.
The YY are learning from us. What can we learn from them?
I think one of the things that I always think about when I'm thinking about the YY is the sort of stunning variety that humans can exhibit in living on the planet, that there isn't one way to do things, and that we really don't have to worry that there will only be one way to do things, as long as we can allow people to keep practicing things which they find important. You'll see that this kind of continued variety will probably stand us in good stead in the future when we're looking for answers to problems which we haven't solved yet.
But what can we learn from their culture?
I think the sense that they're proud of who they are, that they have the ability to reproduce themselves both physically and ideologically, and that they care about one another in a kinship sense rather than just a sort of stranger to stranger sense, and that they continually engage with their environment. They're listening and seeing and thinking about their environment, and they're not disconnected from it.
And those are all things that we have lost somehow in America all too often.
I think at different points in our lives, if not just you know, on a daily basis, we might lose touch with things which would probably serve us better if we were able to articulate.
We want to thank today's guest, UW Stevens Point Professor of Anthropology, Stephanie Alleman. Stephanie, thank you so much. It's a fascinating story. Thanks also to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Lila Roche, our online producer, Scott Clark. Thanks, as always, to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. A reminder, you can communicate with us now on Twitter and Facebook. Next week on Route 51, a special show before a live audience at the Lee Aucke Woodson Art Museum in Wausau as we examine the art and influence of painter Norman Rockwell. Our guest photographer Kevin Rivoli, whose book In Search of Norman Rockwell's America features side-by-side comparisons of his photos and the artist's paintings. It's been a fascinating hour. Thanks again for riding with us today. Until next week, we are heading out of town.